You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the May 2022 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of Modern Folklore by Tressy McMillan Cottom, with photos by Miranda Barnes, sittings editor Nicole Chapoteau. Like Russell, Olodokun came by her musical inheritance through a circuitous route. Her family is Nigerian-American. She grew up in Casa Grande, Arizona, which is midway between Tucson and Phoenix. But like generations of Black American musicians, Olodokun's musical training happened in church. The Evangelical Church, to be exact. She worked at the church and led music worship until she could not sing the songs that did not recognize who she fully was. Today, she is an out queer Black woman and can joke about that time in her life. For a while, my audience was a lot of white Christian college girls. My music sounds like worship. I could play it at a coffee shop at Liberty University. I bend over laughing at the image of Olodokun laying down a deep, soul-inflected groove for a bunch of conservative Christian, mostly white co-eds at a university where they agree to a moral purity code. Still, it is not hard to imagine that it was difficult for her to leave. If I strip away all the political and the motivations that sometimes come with religion, especially in this country, and just go back to the basics of what attracted me to it, I love the idea of treating people well and being treated well, says Olodokun. I love the idea of taking care of the planet and taking my work just seriously enough that I can be proud of what I made at the end of the day, but not so seriously that I have no time to be with family or people that I care about. Her love ethic also infuses her political critiques. On I See America, love supplants ego, making a concept song less preachy and eminently more enjoyable, and making hers unique. Even when she does a cover, like her ebullient take on the Beatles' Blackbird, Olodokun never sounds like anyone but herself. It takes a lot of courage and discernment to be oneself. Amethyst Kia's path to breakout star is a case in point. Kia, 35, grew up in Chattanooga as a Black girl who really liked rock music. The louder and harder, the better. There was a Scandinavian symphonic metal phase. I'm very much melody first, even when I'm listening to metal. It has to be like melodic metal, like this band Nightwish. The lead vocalist was an operatic soprano. And there was a pop punk and alternative rock phase. She wonders out loud about the optics of her taste. As a Black kid growing up in white suburbia, why is it weird that I like Blink 182 or Green Day? A huge majority of rock and roll is inspired by Black artists. Inspired and created. That creation legacy is what ultimately brings Kia to country music. By 2018, Kia had become a member of Our Native Daughters, a young group playing traditional music so antithetical to metal's raging energy that it is colloquially called old-time music. Our Native Daughters should be remembered like the trio albums by icons Dolly Parton, Emmylou Harris, and Linda Ronstadt. It is a Black supergroup that includes Giddens, Russell, and classically trained cellist Layla McCalla. They put out their first album, Songs of Our Native Daughters, in 2019. Up until working with Rhiannon and Layla and Allison, I kind of adopted a shut-up-and-sing policy, says Kia. I just kept my opinions to myself because I didn't feel safe. having the opportunity to work with four other black women who have all had very similar experiences, it was the first time I was able to discuss how I was feeling and somebody really understand what it feels to be there. Kia's solo debut, Wary and Strange, features as full-throated an identity anthem as one can imagine. Black myself. Making that song signified Kia's growth as a person as much as an artist. Our Native Daughters really gave me the courage to write Black Myself, the most confrontational song and specific song I'd ever written, Kia tells me. It was not just the song itself, or even the very personal lyrics. It was merging her private self with her public image. As is often the case, it took a sisterhood for Kia to own all the parts of herself. Kia is growing alongside her audience, owning her role, leading her own band. I'm going from doing mostly solo singer-songwriter stuff, maybe telling a few stories in between songs, to now I'm playing with a really dynamic and exciting band that is absolutely rock and roll, she says. It is a big deal for a young artist to take the helm creatively and on stage. Being in charge is part of the bigger story each of these artists is writing. Ultimately, only you can make your art. That requires radical authenticity. Authentic storytelling is also at the heart of what Brittany Spencer creates. I'm always telling a story, or I'm talking about something that I learned or observed or experienced down south, Spencer says. I think the art of storytelling is just beautiful. A gifted writer and vocal powerhouse, Spencer, 33, is recording her first full album, but her singles, Sober and Skinny and Sorry's Don't Work No More, already put her in enviable company. She joined Russell and Carlisle on Jimmy Kimmel Live in 2021. Like Russell, Spencer finds creative freedom in this genre. That's why I love country music, she says. You literally can write about anything. You can write about anything, and you can make anything a story, because really everything has a story. Vulnerability weeps from all of Spencer's performances. Even when the song is up-tempo, like Damn Right You're Wrong, her vocal stylings do not rely more on emotion than acrobatics. It is like old-school soul in her careful attention to phrasing to evoke a feeling. Think about the way Lionel Richie enunciates purpose, or Gladys Knight delivers the lyrics, I'd never say no, no, stop loving you. But to be clear, Spencer isn't a throwback artist. Her sound is modern and fresh. Sober and Skinny catapults a come-to-Jesus talk with a man into a delightful little earworm. In a perfect world, you get sober, I get skinny. We live off of more than pennies, she sings to an underwhelming boyfriend. Spencer's willingness to puncture her own delusions as easily as she does those of a puffed-up partner is on full display. It is refreshing, especially amid all the empty bravado sucking up all the air in pop music. One hopes her bold honesty is contagious. Adia Victoria does not have to hope for shit. Victoria, 35, who came out with her critically acclaimed third album, A Southern Gothic, last year, makes music on her own terms and asks for what she wants of the universe. Rolling Stone said the album reclaims the Southern experience. She also started her own podcast, Call and Response. I have been a guest. Victoria is a nimble interviewer who might be gunning for more than Stephen Colbert's musical guest slot. And this year, she is touring North America and Europe. In January 2022, Victoria tweeted Colbert, saying that as two South Carolinians, she from Spartanburg, outside Greenville, and he of James Island, they should get together on his late-night talk show. No more beating around the magnolia tree. We are asking for what we want. She comes by her boldness honestly. Raised in the Bible Belt, Victoria had her share of church hurt and good old-fashioned Southern racism. To survive, she learned to listen first to herself. Setting her own course has made her path rockier than it might have been, but she would not have had it any other way. When I released my first record, Beyond the Bloodhounds, in 2016, I felt that the Americana Association was trying to co-opt me. So I wrote an open letter to the Americana Association. I mean, big old mouth from the South that I am. I basically told them, I'm not your Negro. Victoria had a sketchy path through school, choosing to instead enroll herself in a black girls' school of hard knocks. Some questionable relationships, routinely hotboxing the car with her friend Eric, traipsing up and down the interstate that connects Atlanta to Greenville. When Ronnie Spector died early this year, I realized who Victoria reminds me of. She is tough, yes, but it is scar tissue. As a teenager, she nursed her pain with the blues after a friend left her a guitar. Learning the blues was the first time that I did not feel stupid or crazy, because I knew I wasn't dumb, she said. But I knew the intelligence that I had was not recognized by the Southern Christian world that I grew up in. So the blues allowed me, for the first time, autonomy. At its core, Victoria says her music is blues. The blues, for me, they were the original punk rock. They were able to stand outside of the system of mainstream mores and morals and be comfortable there. That was my first, oh, so I don't have to change. I don't have to give up these parts of myself. I just got to figure out a way to be the orchestra leader of them. She doesn't mean the blues that caters to white audiences by offering them their singular approved version of a black artist. She means music that troubles your spirit by reminding you that you have one. Next photo, Brittany Spencer, EP, Compassion. Liner notes, the Baltimore native received the Internet's approval when her cover of the Highwayman's Crowded Table led not only to viral notoriety, but an invitation from the group to tour with them. All of them, Joy, Allison, Amethyst, Adia, Brittany, are asking for all of it. Their claim to contemporary country music reaches back before genre sliced culture into commodities, back to the root of the thing, as Angela Davis might say, of country music's glaring erasure of black artistry. The root of the thing is the drum and the guitar that traveled with enslaved people across choppy waters, some to islands and others to colonized indigenous nations. It is a rhythm, yes, and a vocalization. It is a legacy of storytelling and survival. It is what soul music is at its very core. Whatever genre these artists choose, they are making music for the soul. It may have taken them some hard knocks to find it, and a global crisis for me to find them, but theirs is clearly music for who we could be. green gold. Cobalt mining has long had a dirty rap, with commodities, kingpins, wringing riches from the Congo. Yet the world demands ever more of the metal. So a billionaire alliance featuring Jeff Bezos, Bill Gates, and Michael Bloomberg is striking out for the Arctic, where profiteers are the new preservationist, by Willem Marx, with photographs by Richard Moss. Opening photo, thin ice. Once a coal mining town, Kalasat in Greenland now stands emptied of residents. And the photo shows a very snowy and barren landscape, with houses dotted here and there, far apart. Mountains on one side, water on the other. As the bankers from J.P. Morgan's London offices stepped off the two-hour private flight from Johannesburg onto the hot runway, soldiers sporting sunglasses and semi-automatics watched them closely. The Democratic Republic of the Congo's brutal civil war had ended several years earlier, but peace remained tenuous, and the Lubumbashi airstrip was still heavily militarized. It was the summer of 2006, the height of a period that became known as the commodities supercycle, in which a hardy vanguard of investors sought to sate industrializing China's seemingly endless appetite for raw materials, particularly metals. Relying on low-cost financing, dealmakers at Credit Suisse, First Boston, HSBC, Goldman Sachs, and Morgan Stanley scoured the world for once state-owned mining assets in need of fresh funds, or those primed for privatization. But the capital markets group at J.P. Morgan had proved more adept than its peers at this international treasure hunt, earning tens of millions in fees thanks to a series of mining company flotations that grew ever more exotic, remote, and risky. And the sortie into the DRC, one of the world's wealthiest nations in terms of natural resources, but among the poorest by gross domestic product, sat at the riskiest end of that spectrum. Once their customs paperwork was handled, the bankers reboarded the Challenger for a 45-minute flight northwest to a dust-choked mining settlement called Kolwezi. Before they landed, the pilot circled the prize, Komoto Oliveira Virgil, known simply by its initials KOV, a rain-flooded mining pit named for its biggest three ore bodies, as geologists call deposits, each one the size of an underground Manhattan skyscraper. The banker's invitation had come from a handful of foreign businessmen who'd secured the rights to resume digging at KOV more than a decade after the DRC's state mining company essentially abandoned it. The specific draw had been what the owners were claiming was the planet's largest high-grade copper mine, metallic ore so concentrated as to be visible to the naked eye. From the air and the bright June sunshine, though, as one mining executive put it, KOV looked like little more than an effing big hole in the ground. You might as well go scuba diving or water skiing. Beneath 5 million or so gallons of floodwater, in addition to all that copper, surveys suggested a spectacular trove of another metal, cobalt. To the bankers peering down from the jet, the cobalt was incidental, an ingredient in aircraft turbines, and so it happened part of the mine. Nobody ever thought it was at all strategic or important, remembers one of those bankers, Michael Rawlinson, who now holds top positions at several mining firms. But Daniel Gertler, 32 at the time, and the youngest of the businessmen involved, saw raw opportunity. This deal would help him move beyond his family's trade in diamonds to become a player in the commodities world, cementing him as a dominant force in the DRC's economic engine and the country as the source of some 70% of the world's cobalt supply. The cobalt that today remains unmined at KOV, one of Gertler's largest remaining interests in the DRC, is worth more than $39 billion. The metal has become a critical component in the global transition to a greener future, a reality reflected in its soaring price, $29,000 per metric ton in July 2020. By the time this story went to print in late March, $82,000 per ton. Most lithium-ion batteries depend on cobalt, and everything from iPhones to Teslas depends on those batteries. One analytics firm estimates the worldwide market for electric vehicles and consumer electronics will drive cobalt demand at least three times higher by the end of this decade. But the green gold has become a dirty business. Bad enough that Elon Musk has vowed to engineer cobalt out of his vehicles, with a small coterie of individuals and companies growing immensely wealthy from the DRC's resources at scant benefit to ordinary Congolese people. In 2019, a U.S. human rights organization filed suit against Tesla, Apple, Dell, and other tech giants on behalf of the families of 14 children killed or injured mining in the DRC. The lawsuit was dismissed in November. Meanwhile, Gertler and dozens of companies linked to him are under U.S. sanctions for allegedly corrupt deals, while Glencore, the Swiss-based commodities giant and current majority owner and operator of KOV, faces ongoing investigations from the U.S. Department of Justice and the Commodities and Futures Trading Commission, as well as Britain's Serious Fraud Office, Switzerland's Office of the Attorney General, and the Netherlands' Public Prosecution Service. The U.S. Treasury used an NGO's calculations that indicated Gertler was responsible for stiffing the DRC on more than $1.3 billion in lost revenue between 2010 and 2012 alone. Although Gertler found brief reprieve in the final days of the Trump administration, courtesy of Steven Mnuchin, Biden administration officials swiftly reimposed sanctions. As a result, Gertler, who is Israeli, is prohibited from using U.S. financial institutions and is largely barred from the international banking system. One of his lobbyists, Trump impeachment lawyer Alan Dershowitz, has insisted that Gertler has complied with U.S. and international law. But Vanity Fair interviews with banking officials and experts in enforcing U.S. sanctions, alongside reviews of multiple financial and corporate documents, indicate Gertler has continued to try to circumvent restrictions, even as he receives royalties from the company that operates KOV. Mines are finite, though, and as cobalt's value skyrockets, so does the significance of its role in the economic contest between Beijing and Washington. In an effort to simultaneously save the planet and turn a profit, an enterprise funded by, among others, a swashbuckling half-trillionaire group that includes Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, and Michael Bloomberg, has set its sights as far afield as Greenland, whose citizens may eventually embrace such lucrative pursuits too. The search occupies the minds of a growing army of geologists, software engineers, and data scientists at Cobalt Metals, a U.S. technology firm focused on accelerating and expanding the exploration process for cobalt and other so-called battery metals, including nickel. The lack of alternatives to Congolese cobalt is a major motivator for Cobalt's workforce, according to co-founder and CEO Kurt House, a Harvard PhD who wrote his thesis on carbon dioxide capture. We can't solve all governance problems of the world. We can't solve corruption and labor, at least on our own. But what we can certainly do is diversify supply, he told me on a video call from Northern California. One location where his firm hopes to find cobalt and nickel is Disko, an island slightly larger than Delaware and Rhode Island combined. It lies off the remote west coast of Greenland, the ice-riven North Atlantic landmass with 57,000 residents that President Trump considered trying to buy from Denmark, its former colonial power. If we diversify supply, if we find a major cobalt discovery in Greenland, we can guarantee that cobalt is going to be produced under extremely high labor standards and extremely high environmental standards. And then you have a choice, House posits. Apple can then buy its cobalt from us, where it'll have a really reliable chain of custody and no corruption issues and no child labor issues and minimal environmental impact. In 2019, cobalt received backing from one of Silicon Valley's top venture capital funds, Andreessen Horowitz, and further firepower from Breakthrough Energy Ventures, a multi-billion dollar funding vehicle created by Microsoft co-founder Gates and seeded by a bold-faced group that includes Bezos, Bloomberg, Ray Dalio, David Rubenstein, Jack Ma, Reid Hoffman, and Sir Richard Branson. The fundraising ran into the tens of millions of dollars and gave Cobalt a four-year financial runway for preliminary exploration efforts at more than a dozen sites, including in Greenland. A more recent round brought in a further $192.5 million, and the high demand forecast should help attract future loans and bigger projects, even in one of the world's most inhospitable locations. By the time our Air Greenland charter helicopter tilts northwestward at dawn, there's only a dusting of the previous day's seasonal snowstorm, which grounded all flights. Disko Island's desolate jumble of ridges, valleys, and glacial ice forms, a ragged baseball glove, facing west to Baffin Bay and the Canadian Arctic beyond. Beside me, Hans Jensen points out where a new, longer runway will be blasted from a headland's small hillock. At the edge of Greenland's third largest town, Ilulissat, useful for bringing miners and equipment in, he explains through his headset. Jensen is the chief operations officer for Blue Jay Mining, Cobalt's exploration partner in the far North Atlantic, and has been waiting to revisit an abandoned town on Disko called Kulisat that will serve as a geological exploration camp this summer. A Dane with a shaved head and a blonde gray goatee, he has spent his adult life working in Greenland, first landing on Disko in 1987. Below us, as we cross the channel from the mainland, deep anthracite-colored inlets and fjords are occasionally marked by lighter currents. Steep cliffs of black stratified rock hug the shoreline near Kulisat, their staggered elevation accentuated by thin lines of packed snow. The abandoned settlement was once a prosperous town, pretty enough to feature on a Greenlandic postage stamp. Now, from above, it resembles a series of ragged matchboxes, variously red, yellow, blue, and pewter. Jensen identifies a large rust-colored building on a knoll as the possible home of a future site manager. The air is bitingly cold, painful punishment for any exposed skin. A solitary iceberg loiters offshore, a stone's throw from where the old main street peters out at the beach. In its quest for quality and quantity, the global commodities market has rarely cared for its climactic surroundings or distinctive color palettes. but the cobalt that Kobold and Blue Jay hope to discover beneath Disco's stark, frigid, and remote surface will differ greatly in its geology from that found in the lush, heavily populated mining belt of southeastern DRC and northern Zambia. And the cobalt will likely coexist with much larger quantities of not just copper, but nickel as well. These kinds of ore bodies, known as magmatic sulfide deposits, can be relatively deep underground and difficult to locate. But once identified and extracted, their metal can be easier to process. Millions of years ago, heat from the Earth's core rose up to the mantle, forming magma. If that magma reacted with enough sulfur from the surrounding rock layer, the products, nickel or cobalt sulfides, might separate out as a more stable form and sink into the keel, the underside of a larger tube of magma. Ideally, that keel is what House calls chock full of the really good stuff. The absence of those metals in higher layers of the magma is often a good indication of a keel's presence. Disco seemed to show an exciting absence. "This is the best Norilsk analog in the world," House had said before the trip, referring to a Siberian deposit site that was originally mined by Gulag prisoners under Stalin. Today, a company called Nornickel is the world's largest producer of refined nickel, and its mines in the Norilsk region produced more than 4% of global cobalt in 2021. Over the past decade, the deposit has helped generate more than $120 billion in revenue. The two largest stakes in it are controlled by prominent Russian oligarchs. One, Oleg Deripaska, was sanctioned by the U.S. in 2018 for his links to the Russian government following Vladimir Putin's 2014 invasion of Crimea. The U.K. sanctioned Deripaska in March. The other, Vladimir Potanin, saw around $3 billion of his net worth temporarily wiped the day Russia invaded Ukraine in February. Among the earliest Western geologists to visit Norilsk, then part of the USSR, was a man named Peter Lightfoot. His knowledge is encyclopedic, according to House, who sought him out as one of Kobold's earliest hires. A Canadian mining firm, Falconbridge, subsequently and coincidentally acquired by Glencore, had asked Lightfoot to evaluate Disco's deposits back in the 1990s. At an early Kobold staff meeting, he had wowed his new colleagues by recalling the Falconbridge data with unfathomable precision. It was almost like a parlor trick, House says. But by the time Gertler was beginning his DRC copper cobalt acquisitions in earnest, the then-independent Falconbridge had abandoned further exploration on Disco after several drill holes turned up zip. It was an all-too-common, cost-related decision in the boom-and-bust mining industry, but it left behind some tantalizing breadcrumbs. It has all of these signals. It has all of the right rocks, and it's still not tested, Lightfoot told me, of the territory that is now the center of his focus. Despite pressure to phase out hydrocarbons from global energy supplies, the exploration budgets of oil and gas giants continue to dwarf those of even the largest mining firms looking for battery metals. Consequently, big mining companies tend to spend more money where they already know something exists. The chances of success are higher, explains Lightfoot. With help from Jensen and Blue Jay, Kobold's exploration on Disco this summer will start with airborne surveys, employing various technologies to measure the density, magnetism, and conductivity of larger tracts of land, along with electrical readings and geochemical analysis of sledgehammered rocks. Next photos. Harbor's Bazaar, a view from the Blue Jay offices overlooking the growing town of Ilulissat, Greenland. And homeland, as settlement inhabitants move on to more economically viable areas, the still-standing homes are all that remain. What makes Kobold unusual are its proprietary machine learning algorithms that can process data on a daily basis, mapping results into pixelated predictive atlases that can help geologists on the ground determine the next day's exploration and sampling targets. It's not hard to see the trimmed cost, both financially and environmentally. The technique should solve a sequential planning problem that has long bedeviled mining exploration efforts, according to Jeff Kayers, a Belgian-born director of Stanford University's Center for Earth Resources Forecasting, who examines Kobold's data as part of his academic research, while advising the company, "You want to drill with the idea to confirm or to walk away," he explains, something House describes as the speed to kill. If there's no there, Kobold can redeploy quickly with less impact on the land and its financial outlays. A lot of what we're doing is trying to create both the culture and the DNA in the company that will fail fast and fail proudly, says House. Kobold's almost instantaneous feedback loop represents a startup approach the mining industry has never fully considered. The first several dozen employees, curious, technically capable people who want to understand the cosmos around them, were the co-founder's top choices for each position, House says. The Stanford connection also helped attract Andreessen Horowitz, where general partner Connie Chan says Kobold's ability to hire world-class talent encouraged her to invest in a sector that was outside her usual consumer tech wheelhouse. As part of her due diligence, Chan and her team examined the broader battery industry, since the challenges around cobalt supply have encouraged researchers to experiment with replacing cobalt. But Chan says the literature and experts gave her reassurance about future demand for cobalt, at least in the medium term. A lot of the other experiments around different kinds of batteries, I think, have a far, far, far lower chance of working, and for sure not in a time frame that could be commercialized in the next decade, she says, on a call from Los Angeles, where she lives. House admits cobalt supply shortages and price spikes could make the metal less affordable, but its properties ensure it remains the best performing option. If God gave us a different periodic table, he quipped, then things would be difficult, but it just is what it is. At Apple, cobalt remains a cathode constituent, but auto manufacturers may see it differently. A vehicle battery requires several thousand dollars of cobalt, a phone handset just a few cents. To electrify the world's automotive fleet at current market prices, we need a tremendous amount of metals, House acknowledges. According to Kobold's calculations, using International Energy Agency estimates, the necessary discoveries of new cobalt, nickel, lithium, copper, and rare earth elements will be worth around $10 trillion at current prices. But, says House, we're staring down the barrel of catastrophe, referring to the challenges in the context of climate change. Otherwise, you fry. We're supposed to be going after the biggest, hairiest problems that are around, says Eric Toon, the technical lead on the investment committee at Breakthrough Energy Ventures, the $2 billion plus fund established by Gates that has backed Kobold. There's almost no way to wrap your head around what scale means when we get talking about energy, he says. $1 billion is certainly a significant amount of money, right? But compared to the amount that's required to do what we're trying to do, it's a drop in the bucket. There's no other opportunity like the one that's provided by people like Mr. Gates, Toon concludes, which is why you really don't want to F this up. Next photo, powder room. Beneath the ridges of Disco Island is a potential wealth of battery metal deposits. With a staff that's roughly 70% PhDs, Breakthrough aims to back businesses it thinks will more quickly reduce carbon emissions. In 2019, it began vetting cobalt, first by gauging its potential to reduce emissions. The minimum is at least half a gigaton per year of carbon dioxide, says Toon. Then, by scrutinizing its technical feasibility, leadership, and business plan. Breakthrough invested in the same early funding round as Andreessen Horowitz, while Norwegian state-owned oil and gas giant Equinor subsequently purchased a stake. More recently, Cobalt's machine prospector has intrigued one of the mining world's traditional behemoths, BHP, and the two are now partnering to explore a swath of Australia, equivalent to roughly 6% of the country's entire landmass. But rather than just lease out its software like a contracted supplier, Cobalt's famous backers have helped it financially to co-invest with other mining businesses, as it has done with Blue Jay in Greenland. I don't want to get paid a few million dollars in service fees, says House, hypothesizing. I want to own half of the $10 billion asset we discovered together. The history of the KOV pit near Kolwezi is crucial to an understanding of the current stakes. After touring the site back in 2006, Rawlinson and his J.P. Morgan colleagues were whisked in battered SUVs to the Pink Palace, the only guest house in town. Run by a Belgian couple, it offered mattresses resting on concrete slabs. During Belgium's colonial rule that ended in 1960, and for some time after, KOV and the nearby town had helped drive the DRC's export economy. But after decades of underinvestment by a state-owned company, most of the region's pits and underground mines had flooded or fallen apart. Equipment had rusted, workers had gone unpaid. Rawlinson had only just taken the reins at J.P. Morgan's European mining team when one of Gertler's business partners approached the bank for help financing the KOV pit. Rawlinson was astounded by the industrial archaeology site they encountered, a forgotten hellhole without even a reliable power grid. As for Gertler, the bankers knew few details about the origins of his ownership stake, just that it represented his first substantial foray into mining metals. Much of his prior experience lay in the diamond sector, and they had heard he was close to the country's youthful president, Joseph Kabila. Gertler and his partners had chosen the Isle of Man, off the English coast, to register KOV's new holding company. They named it Nicanor, for a semi-mythic figure who miraculously transported a pair of copper alloy doors from Africa to Jerusalem for its holy temple. During the mine visit, the group passed kids, some looked barely past adolescence, digging in piles of discarded mining byproducts known as tailings, or carrying sacks of a cobalt ore called heterogenite. A video taken from inside the KOV pit in 2006 shows two children standing close to two adult locals, described by the man filming as artisanal miners, independent contractors who sell their mined ore to roadside cobalt traders. One of the children in the video throws a rock toward a Nicanor group and other visitors. That same summer, the NGO Global Witness published a report that called for a strengthening of regulations against child labor in the Congo, where the presence of children in the mines is so visible, the authors wrote, that it is very unlikely that companies would not be aware of the problem. A source close to Gertler told Vanity Fair that he would never approve of children working in danger, not least because he has 11 of his own. A spokesperson for Glencore, which took control of the mine in 2009, emailed the magazine that there are no teenagers under 18 working for our operations in the DRC. We do not tolerate any form of child, forced, or compulsory labor anywhere in our business or our supply chain. Gertler, meanwhile, introduced the bankers to local officials, including the governor of the province, whom he referred to as a brother. Future trouble may have been foreshadowed, but the J.P. Morgan team worked to minimize Gertler's role and focused instead on the abandoned pit's potential, forging ahead with plans for Nicanor's imminent IPO. Buried in the prospectus, shared with potential investors, was an acknowledgement that Gertler had by then already faced allegations of improper dealings with the government of the DRC. That lawsuit was dismissed, tied to the country's diamond mines. The implication was that he had helped very senior officials line their pockets. As the IPO's sponsors, the bankers ensured he was kept away from the London boardrooms, where they pitched pension trust and hedge funds, and they recruited Jonathan Leslie, a former head of copper at mining giant Rio Tinto, to act as executive chairman, alongside a new finance director, Peter Sidney Smith. Both executives declined interview requests from Vanity Fair. Nicanor shares attracted $800 million when they began trading in July 2006 on London's alternative investment market, instantly making it the exchange's most valuable business. On paper, Gertler's 15% of the company was suddenly worth around $225 million, born of an initial investment that has never been disclosed, but on paper was zero. Gertler did not comment. Problems quickly emerged. Bateman, a consulting firm owned by one of Gertler's fellow shareholders, Benny Steinmetz, had conducted the feasibility study prior to the public offering, but after the IPO, it became apparent that the methodology for doing the costing was not accurate, Nicanor's head of funding at the time, Brian Scallon, told Vanity Fair. Lowball projections may have helped entice UK investors, but now they meant the company would require hundreds of millions in further funding to get off the ground. The news incensed the J.P. Morgan team, who felt they and their market clients had been hoodwinked. After failed talks with a potential Chinese suitor, and as Nicanor's stock price started sliding, Gertler and Steinmetz sought to take the company private again with help from Glencore, which increasingly wanted not only to sell metals to a global market, but to mine them too. The privatization plan was a highly unusual and controversial move for a recently listed business and prompted more angry recriminations. So, facing stiff resistance from Executive Chairman Leslie and J.P. Morgan executives, Gertler and his original partners used their controlling shares to instead vote through a $736 million cash injection that left Glencore with a sizable stake and significant control over Nicanor, including the ability to decide its top executives and the right to sell all mined material. Part of that cash included a $297 million Glencore loan to a Gertler-controlled company in the Cayman Islands, which massively expanded Gertler's share in the business and unpicked the previous efforts of the J.P. Morgan team to downsize his role. Gertler's increased shareholding wasn't disclosed until several hours after the sale had gone through, and only then under duress, and Glencore's loan to Gertler's company was only incidentally disclosed months later in a separate firm's financial filings. It was the first of more than a dozen transactions between Gertler and the Swiss firm that revolutionized global cobalt production, generating geysers of cash and collateral damage. Many of the sales, loans, and divestments involved companies incorporated in offshore jurisdictions like the British Virgin Islands, where ownership is unidentifiable. Some had Congolese names. Ruwenzori is a mountain range that borders Uganda. Others, like Ellesmere Global Limited, offered a patina of British-sounding respectability. But what united many of these Gertler-affiliated corporate entities and trades was their utter opacity, making it hard for anyone to learn how his businesses had won access to prized Congolese mines, when exactly they had traded, or where the dollars, or euros, or Congolese francs ultimately ended up. The unwelcome attention that shoddy mining operations have drawn over the years continues to scare major miners and investors away from the country's mineral riches and is indirectly driving the discovery efforts 6,500 miles away in Greenland. Kupik Kleist was one of the last children born in Kulisat, the result of a Danish craftsman's union with a local woman. He was adopted by an aunt and uncle, the town's telegram operator, who punched out a final message to confirm the settlement's closure on his own way out of town. Like many Greenlanders of his generation, Kleist was dispatched at an impossibly young age to a boarding school hundreds of miles away, where he pursued his education assiduously, all the while internalizing his anger over the unilateral closure of his hometown. He later led Greenland's negotiations with Denmark over autonomy, and in 2009 became the first prime minister of the self-governed nation, at the time publicly welcoming foreign investment at every opportunity. People from Scandinavia had arrived on a Greenland inhabited by Inuits in the mid-13th century, and the impacts of colonialism linger to this day. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.